All right, guys, I need you to go ahead. If you've got your Bible, why don't you go ahead and open it up to Matthew chapter 5. Maybe you want to grab your phone and get onto your app and open up to that. I'm going to point something out to you in a little bit, but I want you to kind of be ready. I'll let you know when we get there, but just so you know, kind of look ahead. Get to Matthew chapter 5. Now, we're going to start with this question. How do you think the world is doing right now? That's what I thought. Yeah. It's a general question. You can answer that however you want. Maybe you want to give it a letter grade, something from like an A to an F. Maybe you would give an A because you think everything is just great and perfect and everything's working the way you want it to. Maybe you would give it a B because you recognize that it's, you know, good, but there's some room for improvement, right? And maybe you would give it a C because you see that there's some deficiencies that are causing a few problems here or there. Maybe you'd give it a D because you don't just see deficiencies, you see major issues. But it's not like the world's on fire, or maybe you would just give it an F for fire, right? Like there's just a major, massive problem. Now, I don't know anyone who would give the world an A right now. I probably know more people who'd be willing to give it an F. I would suppose that most of us are somewhere in between. The world seems to be a mess to varying degrees by everyone's opinion, which means that you probably think that there's some things that need to change in the world. So how would you change it? What would you do? How would you fix it, right? How would you go about bringing the change? It's not so much to me even what change would you make. It's more of how would you go about changing it? Maybe you'd want to control everyone else's votes. Or maybe you would want to make yourself king or the president and you'd try to change everything from a position of authority. Or maybe you'd gather a group of people around you that have like-minded convictions and shared goals and together you could try to make an impact on the world. What's your strategy? How would you go about changing the world? Now, I asked my favorite AI to give me a strategy on how it would change the world. And he gave me a terrifying answer. And I kind of cried under my desk for a little bit, freaked me out, and I realized I needed to clarify my question. And so instead of asking AI how it would change the world, I instead went back to it and said, how could a person go about changing the world? And this is what it gave me. It says you should first start by working on you, which that was an interesting answer. It suggested that you would increase your ability to execute and adapt and create. You could work on yourself and make a better version of yourself. In fact, it even referred back into history and looked at world changers. Look at that. It's been one of those days. Put it right there. So it goes back and it looks at world changers and it talked about how they were usually high-level, high-agency individuals who had their own personal strengths. And it said, work on yourself, maybe even for several years, to kind of build that type of a thing within you. Be ruthless in your pursuit of self-improvement. Study success stories and read primary sources and run personal experiments. Track what's working. It even suggested that you would expose yourself to some discomfort. And then after all of that, AI says you need to build around reality. You need to work for close alignment between what you believe and what is actually true, which again is a very fascinating answer to me. AI says most world-changing efforts fail because they're built on what it calls distorted models. It's kind of like when people choose an ideology over evidence of how things actually work in this world. So it says you need to live in reality. It suggests that you would avoid any sort of status games of academia or media or politics in any of those spaces that are going to punish truth. It says, seek environments that reward accuracy even over belonging. Which is, again, all very interesting answers. And then the third step was emphasizing coordination. Share your ideas in books and essays and conversations or high-quality ideas, right? They're going to spread if they are true and also useful. And so focus on that clarity and usefulness over some sort of just a simple, quick, viral outrage. Said invest in humans, invest in your kids or your mentees, your collaborators. Even said this, which I really like this. It said one excellent next generation beats many mediocre movements. And so AI says that if you recognize the world around you is messy, and if there's any part of you that is interested in helping bring that change, then you need to start by working on yourself, build around reality, and then coordinate. And that's how you could change the world. There you go. That simple, right? We all think the world's a mess. This is how we could fix it. Problem solved. Well, there is another way. 2,000 years ago, there's a guy named Jesus who felt the same way about the world that we do. He agrees that it's a mess. In fact, he thought it was such a big deal that he went to some pretty extreme lengths to bring positive change to the world. He came up with a strategy, and that strategy will probably surprise you, but you may decide you want to be a part of it. It's Matthew chapter 5. We're going to start in verse 13. These are Jesus' words, where he teaches. He says, "You are the salt of the earth, but the salt loses its saltiness. How can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and to be trampled underfoot." He said, "You're the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. And in the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." Now, Jesus never mentions the word change in these verses, but he does give us two very clear images of what it looks like to be a part of his kingdom and the ways that it can change the world. And the first image that he gives us is the image of salt. Now, the primary uses of salt in Jesus' world would have been somewhat similar to ours. In Jesus' day, salt was primarily used to preserve food and also to flavor food. Salt has an ability to pierce, to penetrate into whatever environment it may be in. Now, we don't use salt as a preservation or as a preservative as often. It happens in some places, but not so much anymore, because we have refrigerators and freezers, and they kind of do that preserving thing for us. But in Jesus' day, without the modern luxuries that we have, food is going to spoil very quickly if you don't have salt. Salt preservation was a staple of their daily life. And salt enabled people to store food for months or longer. It allowed them to transport it over distances and to even survive seasonal shortages. They used salt to preserve fish and other meats. And they would take other types of food like olives or vegetables, and they would preserve them in a salt brine, kind of like a pickling process that you may be familiar with. And then they would do similar things with even cheeses and fruits and all sorts of different techniques that they had. And all of this was especially relevant for Jesus, who was teaching in an area that he lived in that was near the Dead Sea, which served as a major source of salt. Salt was abundant, very accessible within his region. And so when Jesus is talking to this large crowd and he mentions salt, everyone in his audience needed it, everyone in his audience had it, and everyone in his audience used it. And they immediately thought of preservation and flavor. Salt pierces its environment to preserve and to flavor. And that's what Jesus' movement has looked like since the beginning of the church. Christians have become responsible for preservation. In many ways, the church has become the conscience of culture. The church preserves morality and justice and social conscience. Preservation is salt-like work. And the community of God is also flavored the world in very significant ways. The church can be credited for many advances in all sorts of different fields like science and medicine and things like prison reform and orphanages. The church is heavily involved in the abolition of slavery and the ending of child labor. The church was fundamental in the development of education and literacy. It's been the church over and over and over again. We are the flavor of God in this world. The Jesus movement has pierced every social structure. But sometimes the Jesus movement gets it wrong. Jesus acknowledges that when he says that salt can lose its saltiness, which technically isn't true, which is good because Jesus didn't really say that. Salt doesn't lose its saltiness because it's a pretty resilient chemical compound. But what Jesus says could probably be better translated as defiled. or diluted. Think along those kinds of lines. Salt doesn't become unsalty. It just loses its effectiveness when it's mixed with other substances. If you go back to the Dead Sea, sometimes people would walk around the edges of it and they would scrape up the salt that had dried around the edges where the water had receded and it left behind this salt residue. And when you scrape up the salt off the ground like that, you're also going to collect anything else that's lying around on the shores of that sea. And though it contained an element of salt, it could be polluted with that debris that caused it to lose its preserving and flavoring ability. And just imagine, you're walking through the market and you buy some of that salt and you take it home and you begin using it only to find that it doesn't really do anything of value for you. It doesn't add as much flavor as it should. It's not preserving like it should. And so eventually, you just carry that salt outside and throw it out in the middle of the road. Unfortunately, you can look through the history of the church and see where Christians have become mixed with the world, where we have picked up debris from the culture around us, and it's caused us to lose the preserving influence in our societies. And instead of piercing the culture around us, the church is pierced with the debris of the culture. And it's why even though the church has been credited for many advances in our world, and even though we've impacted many different social structures, the church still has a bad reputation for many who are outside of the church. Because unfortunately, there is a long list of abuses from church leaders, scandals of those who proclaim to be a Jesus follower, and there's the negative attitudes from Christians that are all too common and look too much like the negative world around us. It's the debris of the culture piercing us. And according to Jesus, when the church fails, or when an individual Christian fails, or when we don't represent Jesus the way that we should, when we lose our saltiness, the ones who lose are the people around us, because they lose the preservation of Jesus' kingdom, and they lose the flavor of God in their life. Now, Jesus doesn't just call us salty, he also calls us light. And I'm not going to spend as much time on light, but it's a similar metaphor, and it's going to mean the same thing. Light pierces darkness in the same way that salt pierces food in a brining process. And when we talk about light, we're not talking about an illumination of ideas. This isn't about theological knowledge. It's not about having the right confessions of faith or the right beliefs. Light isn't about going to the right church as opposed to the wrong church. It's not any of those kinds of things. Light is about an individual Jesus follower doing good things, doing the right thing. And those right actions are like beams of light into a dark world. And each Jesus follower is called to live in such a distinctly different way that a non-Christian catches glimpses of God. And so we live rightly and we do rightly, and the result is that people see it as they would a beam of light. Now, the Jesus follower who lives out their faith for others to see is on the right track. And that may be a surprise to you, to be able to say that your faith is supposed to be visible. Maybe that catches you off guard. The idea that your faith isn't supposed to be private, maybe that goes exactly against things that you've heard before. Maybe you've been told that your faith is yours, and it's supposed to be kept to yourself, and it's not supposed to be discussed because it's a private matter. Maybe you believe that. Maybe you've said that. That's not Jesus, and it's not the Bible, which means that idea is probably from Satan. A Jesus follower is supposed to actively counter the ways of the world around them. They are supposed to preserve and add flavor like salt. They are supposed to stick out distinctly different, like a light on a hill at night. I grew up in West Texas, and I can remember In my young years growing up, my family would drive to southeast New Mexico every year for Thanksgiving. We'd spend Thanksgiving with my dad's extended family. And on the drive home, late that night, November night, Thanksgiving night, we're driving home in the dark. And it's an hour and a half drive from where we were to get home. And it's just a desert wasteland. There's nothing there. And I can remember just how dark it was. It's a flat area. You could see forever if the sun were up, but it's not up. It's dark, and it's just pitch black. You can't see anything out there, but you can see every light that exists. You could see radio towers long before you'd ever get to them. You could see the drilling rigs lit up because they don't ever take a day off. You could see towns or cities 45 minutes before you'd get to them, because light has this ability to penetrate through the darkness, to pierce through the darkness. It's powerful how light can be visible and seen in the darkness. A Christian's supposed to look like that. A Christian is supposed to pierce the darkness around them. But sometimes we hide our light. And when we do, the world is the one who loses. They're the one who continues down their own dark trajectory. And so Jesus agrees with us. The world needs to change. And the way he does it is like the piercing work of salt in a brine, or the piercing light in darkness. But if we go back to those first verses we looked at, if we look again, maybe the most important word in this whole thing is that word, you. Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world, which makes me go back and wonder who Jesus is talking to. We're told that Jesus is standing on a mountainside and he's talking to some crowds. And this is the stuff that he taught in most of the places he went. But when Jesus would go around teaching, he wouldn't go to the classrooms. He isn't teaching in a religious meeting house. This isn't a courtroom even where ideas are put on trial. Jesus is teaching these things in the open fields and on the mountainsides, and the people who show up to listen are common, ordinary, unremarkable. In fact, maybe you'd call them backwards. Jesus doesn't reserve his teachings for the powerful Romans or the wise Athenians or the religious scholars of Jerusalem. Jesus is teaching a ragtag group of commoners, and he says they are the salt and the light. And that word, that the world doesn't need more influencers or celebrities. Jesus says common people can change the world. Jesus says ordinary people can change the world. And we are talking about the world here, which is fascinating. He doesn't call them the salt and the light of Galilee. He says they are the salt of the earth. They are the light of the world. Because a little salt goes a long way. And there isn't any amount of darkness that can cancel out a little light. Salt and light are pictures of ordinary people living bold, honest lives with God, for God, God's way. Ordinary people living extraordinary lives. And so Jesus chose the underqualified and the overlooked to be his agents of change in the world. And it wasn't just an idea of Jesus's. It's what he did practically. This was his strategy. When Jesus began gathering disciples around him, he chose the underqualified and the overlooked to be his agents of change in the world. Jesus chose disciples that other teachers had skipped over. Jesus picked the people that no one else picked, that everyone else had ignored. He picked the ones who'd already moved on with their life, the people who had no hope or dream of being a religious giant. In Acts, Jesus' disciples are called ordinary, unschooled men. Jesus' opponents would frequently call his friends sinners, because Jesus surrounded himself with the common and the ordinary. And then he begins going around to these fields and mountainsides, and he's preaching to common folk in common places. It probably wasn't too different from Capital City Christian Church in Frankfort, Kentucky. And he tells them that they are his plan to change the world. And it's still true. Cap City, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. You are called to live bold, honest lives with God and for God, God's way. And our world desperately needs more people like that. Years ago, I had a friend lament that he wasn't making enough of an impact on the world. He was a very convicted guy, especially when it came to politics, and his convictions were about how he voted and what he believed, and he thought that those convictions could change the world for the better if he could just get more people to be in agreement with him. It's not an uncommon story. I bet you know someone like that. In fact, you might be that person, right? And yet he was lamenting that he wasn't having as much success as he thought he should be having. And so I encouraged him to be a Jesus follower first. Be about Jesus' work first. And then work to influence people second. Not for the sake of politics, not for the sake of anything else, but for the sake of Jesus. And then see if that doesn't begin to change the world third. Essentially, I say prioritize Jesus. And then because you make Jesus first, you're going to become salt and light, and you're going to begin making an impact on a neighbor or a friend or a coworker, where you nudge people toward Jesus second. And then third, watch how the world will begin to change. Now for me, and this is just maybe a nerdy thing, but I'm going to invite you on this journey, okay? What makes all this teaching even more interesting to me is that not everyone Jesus is talking to was a follower of his. Not everyone believed in him. It's kind of like today, not everyone in this room right now is committed to following Jesus. And so what is Jesus saying here? Is this true for all people at all times? Is everyone salt and everyone is light? Or is this a unique reality for people who are his followers? And I think the answer to that question is determined by how you view this passage in a larger context of the Sermon on the Mount. And this is where I get kind of nerdy. This is where I need you to open up your Bible again. You're going to look at Matthew 5, and I want to show you something. In Matthew chapter 5, if you're looking with me, you're going to see this teaching on salt and light is right after the Beatitudes. It's what we've been looking at for the last 8 weeks. And you'll see that this section on salt and light looks like a bunch of other sections that are going to follow it. A lot of what seems like random teachings from Jesus going all the way through the end of Matthew chapter 7. Just each little section is little headings separating them out. So here's a big question. Where does this teaching on salt and light belong? Is the salt and the light connected to the teachings of the Beatitudes before it? Or is it just the first section of new random teachings of Jesus that we're going to see played on for several chapters? Is this section commentary on the Beatitudes, or is it a unique teaching? Does it belong on its own, or is it giving us a picture of the person who is living out the Beatitudes? Now, I personally believe, and it's debatable, but I personally believe that everything in the Sermon on the Mount is tied to the Beatitudes. I think everything is built off of it. I think we've even said it a few times the last few weeks. The Beatitudes don't describe 8 different kinds of people who are blessed by God. Instead, the Beatitudes describe one ordinary person living an extraordinary life. It starts in the beginning with a recognition of our spiritual poverty. And then like steps or stairs, each one kind of builds off the previous until persecution is a reasonable counteraction. And I believe that the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7, is built off of these Beatitudes. I think Jesus begins by showing us what should be, and then he gives us practical implications of how this is lived out. Salt and light serve as commentary, basic illustrations that show us how different and unique life will look when lived on purpose for Jesus. And so then, not everyone is salt and light. It's just those who take seriously Jesus's blessings. And now let's put some of these ideas together. Let's take these big ideas, all right? We started with this idea that Jesus calls the ordinary and the overlooked to be world changers. He calls them salt and light. And the way that they do this is by living very different lives, which is laid out for us in the Beatitudes. Those who live that like that, they find blessings in a kingdom that clashes with the world around it, and it culminates even in a blessing that you would never expect, something you would never call a blessing, when he highlights persecution. And if you pull these things together, it just doesn't make sense. Why would ordinary, normal, regular people get persecuted? And why would a movement of ordinary people who are building a peaceful life around them and around the love of God be persecuted for the way that they live? The only answer that makes sense is because they're changing the world. It's because salt and light pierces. And getting pierced can hurt. Salt has a preserving effect and has a flavoring effect, but it also has a stinging effect. It hurts when salt finds its way into an open wound. And it's true of light as well. Light hurts when it pierces through the darkness and it hits your eyes. I'm sure you've been in that place in a dark room when suddenly a ray of light comes in and it hits you square in your eyeball and it hurts. You close your eyes, you turn away, it pierces. Did you know that salt has been applied to wounds for thousands of years? Long before modern antiseptics. Ancient Egyptians and Greeks and Romans, they used salt, sometimes mixed with honey or other substances, and they would create this ointment and they used it to prevent infection and to promote healing. There's a writing called the Hippocratic Corpus, which was written hundreds of years before Jesus, that noted that salty seawater helped heal wounds, especially among fishermen. There's a guy named Pliny the Elder who lived in the same century as Jesus, who wrote about salt and medical remedies, acknowledging that it could cause significant pain in some cases. Jesus followers, you need to know that if you're going to be salt of the earth, it isn't going to be all preservation and flavor. Sometimes you're going to sting, and then you'll get attacked for it. A Jesus follower's right living can sting those who would rather not acknowledge their wrong living. Anyone who follows Jesus' way should expect to be misunderstood and maligned and mistreated. Now it's worth pointing out as a side note here that suffering doesn't mean you're being salt and light. Some Jesus followers suffer for righteousness, but some Christians suffer because they are insufferable. Dog mentioned that last week when he talked a lot more about persecution. He mentioned that sometimes Christians are persecuted because they're obnoxious. Sometimes we're hated because we're jerks. But for those who want to be salt and light, and for those trying to do things the right way, persecution isn't something you should seek as a Christian, but it may be a byproduct of a person who seeks first the kingdom of God instead of the privileges of this world. And I think this is what it boils down to. If you were arrested tomorrow and you were put on trial for being a Christian, is there enough evidence to convict you? Would the evidence be weak or flimsy? Would it be kind of like that defiled or that diluted salt picked up off the ground? Are you like a light that's been hidden under a bowl? You've kept it to yourself. Or would there be stories of salt and light that were obvious markers of Jesus to all? Would there be evidence that you have changed the world? There's an old Jewish saying is made popular for most of us in a 90s movie called Schindler's List. You may remember it. The saying goes like this: he who saves one life saves the world entire. And I like that. If I could be so bold, I'd like to change it just a little bit, though, for us today. He who changes one life has changed the world entire. I recently heard the story of a woman who was salt and light in her workplace. Over the course of several years, she slowly influenced a coworker who could be best described as cynical. But when that cynical coworker faced a personal crisis, she reached out to the woman who was salt and light, and she began asking her about faith. And that story ends with cynicism converting to commitment to Jesus. And it's salt, and it's light. It's what the kingdom of God looks like. It's the preservation of Jesus' kingdom. It's the flavor of God piercing the lives of people around you. And that woman changed the world. I recently heard of a relationship between a father and son that had been strained largely because of the messes of the father, but later in life, the father found Jesus and he began letting the Spirit work on him and change began happening, and words like patience and honesty and joy became a part of how you would describe this man, things that had not existed before. Those changes in him brought a change to his relationship with his son, and his son softened. And he became curious about Jesus because he experienced salt and light. He experienced the preservation of God's kingdom in this world. He experienced the flavor of God piercing the lives of people around you. And that father changed the world. So don't take it lightly when Jesus says you are the salt of the earth. and you are the light of the world. You are God's plan to change the world. Because Jesus agrees with us, this place is a mess. And the way that you're going to change the world happens the same way that salt and light change an environment. You preserve what is right and of God. You flavor the areas that you're in with the flavor of God. You become a source of light in a very dark world. And that's my prayer for you today. I pray that that's who we would be as a church. I want to invite you to that. Maybe you want to begin a relationship with Jesus and start working through that. I'd love to have that conversation with you. I'll be sitting right up front. We've also got an elder in the back in our prayer room who'd love to pray with you or talk you through what it looks like to follow Jesus. Both those things would be great. Don't miss an opportunity to be about the way that God is trying to change this world. Don't miss the invitation from Jesus on what this could be for you in your life.